Would you like to share something you've heard on Issues Etc. via email, Facebook, Twitter, or text message? We've made it easy for you. Just go to the Listen On Demand page of our website, issuesetc.org, and click Share This. You'll find almost 50 ways to share Issues Etc. audio. We love our on-demand listeners. Old Theology, New Technology, issuesetc.org. Go to the Listen On Demand page and click Share This.
President of the United States, Vice President of the United States, come to the annual prayer breakfast, which began under the Eisenhower administration, and for 58 consecutive years, the President of the United States has attended.
It really is a chance to reflect as a nation on this intersection of faith and politics.
We become absorbed with our abstract arguments, our ideological disputes, our contests for power, and in this Tower of Babel, we lose the sound of God's voice.
The speaker here was Mother Teresa. She gave a strong address against abortion. And then she asked to see me. And I thought, oh dear.
We tend to think of Islam here in the West as a minor religion, something that certainly has a presence, a high profile on the American religious radar of late, but a small percentage of our population, perhaps a greater percentage in Western Europe. And then as you go farther and farther east, you might find greater and greater percentages until there are entire countries dominated by Islam. And we think of it as monolithic, these Muslim-dominated countries, but they're not. There are non-Muslims in these countries. What is life like for a non-Muslim in a country dominated by Islam, not only as religion, but also as politics and law? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. It's Tuesday afternoon, the 9th of February. Our call-in number for the next hour, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org, or you can Twitter us at @IssuesETC. We're going to talk about Islam and the treatment of non-Muslims for the next 40 minutes of the program with Dr. Mark Durie. He's vicar of St. Mary's Anglican Church in Caulfield, Victoria, Australia, and he's author of the new book titled The Third Choice, Islam, Demitude, and Freedom. Dr. Durie, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. It's great to be with you.
What is everyday life like for a non-Muslim in a Muslim-dominated country?
The key idea, the principle, is that non-Muslims have to accept an inferior position. As you said, Todd, Islam is not monolithic, so the circumstances vary from place to place. In some countries, for example, Saudi Arabia, it's actually illegal for Christians to worship together in any context. But in many countries, it's lawful to worship, but it might be incredibly difficult to get permission to build a church, and you'd have restrictions on expressing your faith publicly. In many countries, Christians are greatly at risk if they are accused of blasphemy. Their testimony might be devalued in a court. They have a lot of reasons really to feel insecure and not really at home in their own country.
Where would you cite as kind of concrete examples in the world today where genuine bona fide demitude, the term of art here that we're going to use, submission to Islam as law, if not as religion, where would you cite as concrete examples where that actually occurs today?
Dimitude is a word to describe the situation of non-Muslims living under Islamic law, and strictly speaking, under Sharia law, non-Muslims have to accept a whole range of inferior marks of their status. I think virtually every country, every Muslim-dominated country, has some manifestations of this. For example, in most countries such as Indonesia, Egypt, it can be very difficult to get a permit to build a place of worship. You'll find, for example, Indonesia, which is often held up as a pretty moderate place as far as Islamic countries go, there's no difficulty getting a permit to build a mosque, but very difficult to get permission to build a place of worship for the Christian faith. In in Turkey. There are difficulties again building churches, just for one example. In most Muslim countries, if you change your religion, if you leave Islam and become a Christian, you can experience great difficulties. For example, in Jordan, you become legally a non-person. If you leave Islam and become a Christian, your testimony is invalid in court of law. You lose custody of your children. You can be basically treated as having absolutely no rights at all before the law. So there's just some examples of countries where the principles of dimitude of inferiority apply today.
Take us into, if you can, the worldview that is Islam, the mindset that is Islam. You write in the middle of your book, Islam meaning submission, but there are two kinds of submission according to Islam. Talk about that, if you would.
Yes, the first kind of submission is to become a Muslim, and literally in Arabic you say, I submit, and that means that you're agreeing to become a Muslim. But the second kind of submission is to surrender to the forces of Islam. Islam was spread by the sword in most places, and in fact Muhammad asked his followers to do that, and he said to the Muslims, and this has become a principle that was passed down, that when they go to a new country, they should offer the inhabitants there three choices. One is to become Muslim, to surrender the first way. The other is the sword, for conflict really, or death if people can't escape. But the third is to surrender and live under Islamic dominance. This is called the covenant of the Dhimma, and the peoples that lived under that are known as Dhimmis. It's often not understood that that's how, in fact, Islam spread and achieved its spread around the world. When Pope Benedict gave his speech in Regensburg a few years ago, and he intimated that Islam had been spread by violence, the Grand Mufti of Saudi Arabia responded and said, no, it's not true that Islam was spread by force, because there was a third choice, and this was the third choice, to surrender and agree to live under Islamic dominance. So that's how the institution really developed, this idea that non-Muslims living in an area that's been conquered by Islam are in an inferior situation in their own traditional homelands.
In its sense, so much of Islam today and in history has been tied to the life of their prophet Muhammad. Talk about how the concept of this kind of submission, dimitude, developed in the life and career of Muhammad himself.
Yes, Muhammad experienced in his early career quite a lot of opposition and even persecution, and I don't think he reacted to that very well. He later on took the view that any kind of obstacle to Muslims being successful was a kind of persecution of Muslims. And he took the view that if people stood in the way of Islam being dominant or powerful, they had to be fought against. The Quran says this a couple of times, fight them until there's no more persecution or no more obstacles really to Islam's dominance. And he took quite a lot of offense at the Jews in Medina, where he began to establish himself politically, and gradually eliminated the tribes there, driving them out. And the final tribe, he really just wiped out. There was a genocide. Then later he attacked another Jewish community in Arabia, in a place called Khaybar. And he conquered them and imposed this Dhimma pact upon them that they could those that hadn't been killed in the conflict, that they could stay there, but they had to pay 50% of the tax as really buying back their right to life. And that action of Muhammad in conquering those people became a basis in Islamic law for extending this model to all the different groups that Islam conquered. And it became a principle that non-Muslims could make this third choice, submit to live under Islamic rule. They'd be allowed to keep their religion, so they could stay as Jews or Christians, but they had to accept inferiority in law. And they had to pay a tax each year, which was understood to be a redemption of their blood. That is, the men would pay in order to keep their heads for another year. So they were very precarious, in a sense, in their continued existence. And that was the case for, say, Christians all across the Middle East for 1,400 years until modern times.
I know that you are deeply concerned with issues surrounding human rights, bringing this forward in the 21st century. What should be our concerns about the free exercise of human rights in Muslim countries, given that this is still in place, this demitude is still in place? About a minute before we take a break.
Yeah, the problem is that Islam regards non-Muslims as inferior, and they should be grateful for the status that they have. But the effect this has is that all these discriminatory laws that restrict marriage and worship and the ability to speak freely apply in Muslim countries, and Muslims have a great deal of difficulty seeing that it's unjust to treat non-Muslims in this discriminatory way. So Christians, for example, in Pakistan are in a very inferior and dominated position. We should be very concerned for the millions of Christians who live under the influence of this dhimmi system.
Dr. Mark Dury is our guest. He's vicar of St. Mary's Anglican Church in Caulfield, Victoria, Australia, author of the new book, The Third Choice, Islam, Dhimmitude, and Freedom. We're talking about Islam and the treatment of non-Muslims on this Tuesday afternoon, February the 9th. You can join us. Questions or comments. This break is a great time to call. 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. Talk back at issuesetc.org or Twitter us at issuesetc. Well, one wonders then, why is it that we have not heard about this dhimmi system, about this system of imposed inferiority in law, in politics, in countries dominated by Islam? Why is it that our leaders, otherwise, I think, sincerely concerned about the free exercise of human rights country to country around the world, don't seem to recognize that this system does exist? And what about history? Has this been erased in some ways from our modern reading of Islam in world history? We'll answer those questions on the other side of the break, as well as your questions, 1-877-623-MYIE, or talk back at issuesetc.org.
Greetings from your friends at Zion Lutheran Church, Muskoda, Illinois, a proud supporter of Issues, etc. Zion Lutheran is a welcoming, family-friendly church that's firmly grounded on the unchanging truth of God's Word. We receive God's gifts of grace in a timeless, reverent way each Sunday morning at 10 o'clock. Zion Lutheran is located at 101 South Railway in Muskoda, Illinois. Zion Lutheran is a church home that's both faithful and friendly, and you'll be warmly welcomed. For more information, call 618-566-7345.
Here are two new ways to stay connected to Issues Etc., Facebook and Twitter. You'll find photos of in-studio guests at facebook.com/issuesetc, and you'll find a list of upcoming topics and guests on Twitter at issuesetc. Social networking for the thinking Christian, facebook.com/issuesetc, and on Twitter at issuesetc. Connect with fellow Issues Etc. junkies today, facebook.com/issuesetc, and on Twitter at issuesetc.
Smartest listeners in radio, you're listening to Issues Etc.
We've got nothing against bumper stickers, just bumper sticker theology, and we'd like to send you an Issues Etc. bumper sticker. You'll find the Issues Etc. logo, slogan, and website address. Simply send your request to Lutheran Public Radio, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Please include a self-addressed stamped envelope. Good theology doesn't fit on a bumper sticker, but you can tell people where to find good theology, the Issues Etc. bumper or window sticker.
Thanks to God's gift of the Internet, people are listening to Issues Etc. around the world.
Hi, this is Ville calling from Finland. I believe the day will come when you cannot enter the office as a pastor in the ELCA unless you subscribe to the ordination of gays and lesbians. And why do I believe that? Because Americans are sinners like we Finns are.
Listen to what you want, when you want, wherever you are. IssuesETC.org.
It was Islam that carried the light of learning through so many centuries, paving the way for Europe's Renaissance and Enlightenment.
Islam brings hope and comfort to more than a billion people worldwide.
And throughout history, Islam has demonstrated through words and deeds the possibilities of religious tolerance and racial equality.
Islam affirms God's justice and insists on man's moral responsibility. The killers who take the lives of innocent men, women, and children are followers of a violent ideology very different from the religion of Islam.
Two American presidents opining on Islam, something of an apology for Islam, given what we have learned of late about Islam's, the nature of Islam, especially when it dominates politically in a country. We're talking about the Islam and the treatment of non-Muslims. Dr. Mark Dury is our guest. Dr. Dury, why is it that we hear this quite often from American presidents? Islam is a religion of peace. It seems to be extolled as a great harbinger of human rights and of equality in both politics and religion.
At root, the fundamental problem is the whole dhimma system itself. The non-Muslims are intended by Islam to show gratitude and to express their own inferiority by praising Islam. But those that are conquered are meant to behave in those ways. And what's happening is that this mindset of inferiority and gratitude to Islam is being extended now into the West through intimidation, through sometimes deception. And we've had a number of examples of significant leaders in the West, President Sarkozy, Tony Blair, the two American presidents, Bush and Obama that you mentioned, really praising Islam and giving an apology for Islam. That's a sign, I think, of a community of people who are themselves coming under threat and really wanting to stroke or praise Islam. There's also a lot of deception. People are told many things that are not simply not true. The history of the very painful history of the subjugated peoples, the Christians of the Middle East, is obliterated from our textbooks. We're taught in schools that we should be grateful to Islam for rescuing classical learning or philosophy from the Dark Ages. So that we're really facing a comprehensive ideological campaign that is distorting our view of history and our worldview.
You say that there were certain considerations during, in particular during the period of Enlightenment in Western Europe, when this kind of scouring of history and the elevation of Islam's place in human history took place. Talk about that, if you would.
Yes. I think, for one thing, the Western Church never really properly engaged with Islam. You look at Martin Luther's writings on Islam, he had very little to say, apart from pray and let the emperor or the ruler do the fighting. But there was very little understanding or engagement with Islam. But later on, people who were really opposed to Christianity held up Islam as a supposedly tolerant system in order to beat Christians over the head. And that was really in full swing in the 19th century. And then later, when the Ottomans were seeking the support of French and English and so on against the Russians, it became convenient for the British Empire to say how wonderful it was for everyone living in the Ottoman Empire, because the Ottomans were their ally and they needed that kind of popular support from their own people. So there are a number of factors that go back centuries that have set up this myth of the tolerant Islamic conquest and how wonderful things have been under Islamic rule. Completely baseless. It's a lie, I think. And we're still paying for those errors really going back centuries.
It is often portrayed by our political leaders, sometimes even by religious leaders in the West, that Islam, Judaism, and Christianity are three sisters, and that there's a possibility of some real camaraderie between the three. I wonder whether or not that is a concept born of any truth, or whether or not it is a concept born of this dhimmi system that we've been talking about.
That's a very interesting question to ask, because I think the reality is Judaism and Christianity are very closely linked. Christianity really arises out of Judaism as a kind of daughter faith, as is modern Judaism itself from the faith of the period and the Second Temple. Islam is very different in many ways. I would say that its concept of God is quite different from that of the Bible. And there's a great gap, I think, between Judaism, Christianity on the one hand, and Islam on the other. I don't think Muhammad really knew the Bible at all or had a very clear idea about what it taught. What happens is that Islam itself claims that the biblical prophets were all Muslims. So Jesus, Moses, Solomon are all claimed to be Muslims. If ever there was if ever Solomon built a temple, it was a mosque. And so what Islam does in entering into dialogue with Christians and Jews is it seeks in a way to reclaim those faiths for itself, to say, look, if you really want to be a true Jew or a true Christian, you should come to Islam, come to the faith of Abraham, which is Islam. And this is really designed as part of the effort of proclaiming Islam in the West, is to invite Jews and Christians into a dialogue on the basis of an Abrahamic identity. The other thing that's happening is some Muslim ideologues are really quite determined to erase the concept of a Judeo-Christian heritage in the West and instead to speak of an Abrahamic heritage. And that way, Abraham becomes the inheritance or the true inheritance of the West, of America, and not just any Abraham, but the Abraham of Islam, so that Islam is claimed to be the religious inheritance of the U.S. We saw that a little bit in President Obama's speech, where he said that, you know, Islam has been part of the history of the United States since its inception. There's a process, really, of reclaiming history and rewriting history to make America or England or France, Islamic nations from the bottom up. So I think that this idea of Abrahamic common identity really needs to be looked at very, very carefully, and to realize that it's something in the way that Islam has created in the way that Muslims have engaged in interfaith dialogue with us. I think most people that subscribe to that haven't read the Quran and don't really understand the basic teachings of Islam at all.
Let's go to the phones. Joe is calling from his cell phone. Joe, thank you for waiting. Welcome.
Hi, Todd. I think you may have just answered my question, but I'm wondering, is there something peculiar about Islam that it is thrown up against Christianity, as you said, in the, I guess, 18th, 19th century, that it's portrayed as being tolerant? Operating from the premise that people don't like Christianity because it's the truth, could they have thrown any other religion up against it? Is it because Islam is kind of quasi-biblical, as you were just talking about, with, you know, roots tied to Abraham and that kind of thing?
Good question, Joe. Thank you very much. Dr. Dury.
I think the answer is that the ideology of the Dhimma of Islamic conquest was that non-Muslims should be very grateful for being allowed to keep their lives, so that Muslims can feel superior and also generous in allowing the non-Muslims to live at all. So that Islam has had this attitude that the system that it created, the Dhimma system, is one in which Muslims are very generous to these conquered peoples. Now, that sense of their generosity, then, I think, has culturally kind of been transferred and been taken over by European critics of Christianity, but they just accepted the propaganda, really, that this was a tolerant and generous system. They believed it's like the abuser who is abusing his wife, for example, and tells everyone how lucky she is to be married to him. Well, in this case, people have heard that this is a very wonderful system, and they've just accepted the propaganda, and they haven't looked at properly at what's actually happening on the ground.
Miles in St. Louis emails us, I've heard of Sharia courts being instituted as a kind of parallel legal system in the UK and Canada. Can your guest comment, please? Does your guest see a likelihood of UK or France, for example, falling into full-fledged Islamic government? If so, what's the implication for the U.S.? The first question, what about parallel legal systems under Sharia in Western countries? We've got about a minute before we take a break, and we can continue on the other side.
There are parallel courts all across the Western world, and there are scores of them across the UK. Some of them are actually have the force of law, because in the UK you could submit your business to a tribunal, and that could be organised on whatever principle. So the Brits are in a lot of trouble. It's very difficult for example, women who are in an abused situation in an Islamic marriage. They will take their case to the courts, and they will be dealt with according to Sharia law. It's very disadvantageous for them. So you're getting a whole parallel society developing in parts of the UK with a separate legal system, and that's a serious problem. You'll be finding the same things happening in the US as well.
When we come back from this break, These are the words of a famous Muslim. Thus our talks with the infidel West and our conflict with them ultimately resolve around one issue, one that demands our total support with power and determination with one voice. It is, does Islam or does it not force people by the power of the sword to submit to its authority corporally or, if not spiritually? The answer is yes. The matter is summed up. For every person alive, either submit or live under the suzerainty of Islam or die. The words of Osama bin Laden. He understands the three choices that Islam places before the non-Muslim world, and he says this is the whole reason for the conflict with the West. We'll find out more about that on the other side of the break. 10 more minutes with our guest, Dr. Mark Durie, Vicar of St. Mary's Anglican Church in Caulfield, Victoria, Australia, author of the new book titled The Third Choice, Islam, Dimitude, and Freedom. You can purchase this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Questions or comments for the next 10 minutes of the program on Islam and the treatment of non-Muslims? Twitter us at issuesetc. Email us here in the studio, talkback@issuesetc.org, or give us a call, 1-877-623-MYIE.
These days, value affords me a new attitude. It lets me appreciate that I can start my day with more than a $6 cup of coffee, and that I officially have permission to skip dinner out to spend time talking with my family over casserole in. Concordia Publishing House offers Christian products that help me focus on what matters most. Visit any of the three Concordia bookstores downtown, in Kirkwood, and on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton, or shop online at cph.org and find out what a new value attitude looks like in your life.
Wouldn't it be great if more of your fellow parishioners listened to Issues Etc.? Well, here's an easy way for you to publicize Issues Etc. at your church. Go to the support page of our website, issuesetc.org, and you'll find a short paragraph to include in your weekly church bulletin. Copy and paste the text for your church secretary or pastor to include each week in the Sunday bulletin. The bulletin blurb is updated weekly. issuesetc.org. Stay connected. issuesetc.org.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The generation gap in abortion politics.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Roe v. Wade was an unpopular decision from the start and represented one of the few times in history the Supreme Court has actually ruled against mainstream public opinion. After the ruling, states immediately began restricting abortion, with 34 states now enforcing significant limits. In an important article entitled The Abortion Distortion, New York Magazine's Jennifer Senior addresses the issue of ever-diminishing support for abortion. Much of this is due to the fact that younger Americans are more pro-life than their parents and even their grandparents. Tune in next time for more.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
Won't you please surrender to me? Your lips, your arms, your body.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking about Islam and the treatment of non-Muslims. The choice is simple, classically, from opponents of Islam: submit to Islam by way of conversion, or surrender to Islam politically under law, that is, live as a non-Muslim under the suzerainty of Islam in law, or die. Those are the three choices. Now, we're talking about that second choice, the submission of non-Muslims under Islam. Our guest, Dr. Mark Durie, you can join us, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. Talk back at issuesetc.org or Twitter us at issuesetc. Before the break, Dr. Durie, I read the words of Osama bin Laden as you have them in the last part of your book, and this is kind of shocking to realize how little we know of the logic behind this man and his movement, that he understands fully well the choice that Islam is presenting the entire world. Talk about that, if you would.
Yes, Osama bin Laden is offering a deal, if you like, to America and the entire world in his arrogance. And that is they just surrender and agree to live under the rule of Islam, and they'll be permitted to keep their faith, and then the terrorism will stop, the killing will stop then. So if you want to know what makes him really angry, what makes him angry is that Islam is not ruling, that Islam is not politically dominant, that we haven't become dhimmis. That's the key. What's really disturbing is when sometimes our leaders speak as if they were dhimmis already. You know, we already adopt these marks of inferiority and of gratitude, so that we're suffering a kind of worldview subversion that's pushing us towards the situation where Osama bin Laden wants us to go. A lot of people ask why they're so angry with us. There must be some injustice. We must have done something wrong. Well, what we've done wrong is that we won't accept to live under Islam. We won't make the third choice of living under Islamic rule. It's really, that's the fundamental issue. This is a hidden subject. It's like a taboo subject. You're not supposed to talk about it, really. And it needs to be understood much more clearly, because we will know the nature of the struggle we have in front of us if we can really understand the fundamental theological end game, the direction to which this violence is tending, which is really the defeat of our country and the institution of an Islamic system. That's the goal in Osama bin Laden's mind.
Ken in Orlando, Florida writes, it's ironic that those in the news media in Hollywood and Washington, D.C., who believe Islam is a tolerant religion of peace, would have very little freedom under Islamic rule. Your thoughts there, Dr. Dury?
That's right. And many of those who are very pro-Islam in the West out of complete ignorance would be some of the first to have their rights and their freedoms taken away. I think that's just tragic that people willingly walk into, someone called it in Europe, sleepwalking into Sharia, where you're opening up a door which will be very hard to close. It was tragic that the Archbishop of Canterbury declared that some form of Sharia law should be introduced in the UK. He seemed to be completely ignorant of what will happen to Christians under that system, or what Sharia law means for Christians, or indeed what will happen for women and freedom of speech. Now, these are very disturbing trends that we see are happening now. In Europe, Geert Wilders, a member of parliament, is being taken to court for supposedly vilifying Muslims because he's been speaking out about these issues. So there's a very serious struggle, but battle going on to draw some kind of line to stop this process of Sharia implementation in the West from happening.
What is the role of global terrorism? Because I think it is fair to say that not every Muslim wants to see these things carried out by way of terrorism, but for those that do, and there are many, what is the role of terrorism in bringing about the dhimmitude of non-Muslims?
The ultimate goal is to establish an Islamic State. There's no doubt about that. They understand that this is a long process. And along the way, part of the point of terrorism is to literally strike fear in the heart of the unbelievers. It's to render people more willing in giving what they're meant to give. For example, to try and cause the U.S. or Western powers to withdraw from the Middle East, to create a space in which these more radical Muslims can take control. That would be one goal. But we also see in the West an increasing a tendency to support Islamic agendas, I think, as a result of terrorism. I was really shocked in the UK, speaking to leaders of churches there, to see how frightened they were already. They were saying, look, please don't talk about these things, because if we talk about these things, you know, we might be attacked. They were really wanting to make any discussion of these aspects, less pleasant aspects of Islam, a taboo subject. Now, that is exactly the condition that the dhimmi system is meant to produce, where you don't criticize Islam, you act in an inferior position, you're unwilling to stand up for yourself. So you see, terrorism's already winning some advantages for Islam in the West because of intimidation.
Is conflict of this kind inevitable? Is there nothing but, given the presence and the dominance in some parts of our globe, of Islam, politically and otherwise, is conflict inevitable?
I think one of the problems for people in the West is they don't want to think about these things, and they don't want to think about them because it just their mind just explodes into, oh, this just means conflict forever, and they can't see a way forward. I think you can avoid conflict better if you know when to draw a line in the sand, what you actually stand for and what you will and won't accept. If you act like an intimidated person and continue to hand over and Islamize your knowledge, your sense of history, your sense of identity, conflict will never be able to be stopped. And yes, wars will continue in the 21st century because Islam has risen again, and the drivers for that are theological, and they will continue to be there. The problem of terrorism is not going to go away. But I think countries like America and the UK and France and so on, they could be drawing lines more effectively in the sand. They could be saying, we won't accept this. We won't accept Sharia courts. We're not going to accept polygamy. This is not an Islamic country. It's not an Abrahamic theology that we're supporting. We have a Judeo-Christian identity. We could be a lot clearer about what we stand for. And instead, one of the risks is that we just, in a sense, prepare our children and our national identity for a kind of takeover by surrendering our sense of identity. That's the great risk for us at the moment.
Brett in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Could your guest comment on the medieval Islamic Spanish kingdom? It's always discussed as a model of Islamic tolerance, the ideal Islamic state. I wonder if history has been rewritten here.
Yes, that myth was developed in the 19th century under the conditions that I described before. Some Jewish writers emphasized that because they wanted to hold that up as an example to the Europeans in their sort of anti-Semitism. In fact, if you look at the so-called Golden Age in Andalusia, you'll find that the harems of the Muslim leaders were full of women that had been taken as captives from Christian populations, that the coasts of France and Spain were constantly being attacked and decimated and their populations enslaved, that there was a conflict. In fact, in Andalusia, Jews and Christians were required to wear on their clothing markers of their inferiority. So they'd be wearing a coloured patch that would indicate that they were not Muslims. And the full laws of the demo, which ensured their inferiority, applied. There were massacres and pogroms. It was a very unpleasant time. And yet this mythology has developed about the Golden Age. And that sort of false history really corrodes our sense of identity and our ability to stand up to what's happening in the world today. It's part of the propaganda that we're facing.
Finally, with less than a minute, Dr. Durie, it sounds as though we need some very earnest and thorough remedial education on the nature of Islam religiously and politically. With less than a minute, your thoughts?
I agree completely. We need to understand Islam, and the West has been asleep on this for centuries. We're still fighting the battles of the Reformation in our theological colleges, and they're not unimportant things to know about, but we need to know about what Islam says, what its history has been. The lack of memory is really disturbing. Fox's Book of Martyrs, a very famous text, there were no Islamic martyrs in that book. We need to be engaging with Islam, understanding it properly. I'd commend my book as a resource for doing that. It really it gives a lots of sources and enables people to equip themselves. We need to wake up. We need to educate ourselves. We need to understand Islam a lot better because it's going to be a major issue for us in a century ahead. The challenges that Islam is posing, the challenge of the third choice, is not going to go away in the century ahead of us.
Dr. Mark Durie is vicar of St. Mary's Anglican Church in Caulfield, Victoria, Australia, author of the new book titled The Third Choice, Islam, Dimitude, and Freedom. Folks, when you purchase The Third Choice using the Amazon.com link at our website, a percentage of your purchase will help support the worldwide outreach of Issues, etc. Dr. Durie, thank you very much for your time.
It's been a pleasure, Todd.
When we come back from this break, we're going to discuss a new sex ed education report published by Planned Parenthood. They're concerned about sex education. We'll see what it's all about in the last 10 minutes of Issues, etc. If we fail to understand what Islam is, religiously and politically, if we fail to understand that there is no separation of mosque and state in Islam, that its worldview is of a world dominated, either religiously or politically, by Islam. That they view this as a fair choice they are giving us non-Muslims, a generous choice to submit to them and not die. We should be grateful. We fail to understand this. We fail to understand Islam, period. We'll be right back to talk about sex education. If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most radio talk shows, but not for Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is listener-supported. We rely on you to pay for the production, salary, and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin, asking you to consider making a tax-deductible gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or you can donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio. The address? LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend on you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc. Thanks for your consideration.
Real Reformation Radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks for sending us your email. Having produced Issues Etc. for more than 15 years, I can tell you that we've never received email response like this. Unfortunately, we simply can't reply to all of your email. So here's a way that I can almost guarantee a response to your question or comment. Call the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8384. It's available for your questions or comments 24/7, 618-223-8384.
Would you like to share something you've heard on Issues Etc. via email, Facebook, Twitter, or text message? We've made it easy for you. Just go to the Listen On Demand page of our website, issuesetc.org, and click Share This. You'll find almost 50 ways to share Issues Etc. audio. We love our on-demand listeners. Old Theology, New Technology, issuesetc.org. Go to the Listen On Demand page and click Share This.